Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What's happening, friends? Welcome to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, our monthly interview series where I have the pleasure of sitting down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. And this month, we've brought the show remote. We've traveled far. We're out here at Bethesda Game Studios in Rockville, Maryland, with the great Todd Howard, the Todd Father, the man behind the Elder Scrolls series, the Fallout series, and all kinds of new stuff you guys are cooking up. Todd, thanks so much for inviting us.
Thanks for coming out. It's been a long time in the making when you first brought this up.
Yes, you used to call in to my OXM podcast
back
in the day.
Good times.
That was fun back in the Oblivion and Fallout 3 days. We'll get to all that, but you know, you've had a heck of a career all here. And that's one thing I find super fascinating about you. So, I want to dig into that, but I always like to, of course, start at the beginning. And it's, you know, what You fell in love with RPGs pretty early on, right? Wizardry was a big one for you.
The Ultima series was kind of the first time where, you know, I was a kid who grew up with video games like everybody else who, I think, grew up in the 70s. But Ultima was the first time where I played something, you know, played D&D, where that kind of experience translated, you know, where I felt like I could do a lot of things in the world, despite it being whatever, 16 pixels or 8 pixels by 8 pixel tiles. It felt very real for the time that I was in the game. I go to bed thinking about it and, oh, how am I going to finish this quest? And really just captured my imagination in terms of this is something that I really, really want to do.
There seems to be, I've noticed in doing 30-something episodes of this, there seems to be a pretty high correlation with game developers and tabletop D&D.
Not just gaming. I think a lot of people then, you know, D&D, it's that time period, right, when, I might have the years wrong, 1976 to 1985, that period of, like, D&D and science fiction movies and fantasy and all of that, I think was a big stepping stone from where entertainment was a decade before.
So you mentioned Ultima being big for you as a kid. How old were you back when you first remember getting into games?
I was probably 6 or 7. I wrote my first game when I was 12.
Nice. What was that?
Trash
Do you remember
80.
It?
There was a Star Trek game on the Trash 80, and then I did a ripoff of it. Called
you
Shotgun.
Called the TRS 80 is the Trash 80.
That's what everyone called it. And then the Apple II came out soon after. And then once I got my hands on one of those, I was very much a self-taught Apple II programmer. And I could really, you know, I could make that thing do pretty much whatever I wanted. And that's when computers started coming into classrooms.
Right.
And, you know, I wouldn't suggest I was a great student. I wasn't a terrible student. But in computer class, I was, you know. I was in my own element. Yeah.
What were your favorite games on Apple II?
Well, Ultima, obviously. Prince of Persia came out.
Yes.
Karateka. I used to say it called Karateka, but I understand it's called Karateka. And that was the first game where it has like you know, cinema-style cutscenes and all of these things. And I liked then that I could mess with them. You know, if you knew assembly language or hex editing, then you could go in and mess with the games that I couldn't do on a, you know, Atari or ColecoVision or those kind of things.
So I imagine you've since gotten to meet Jordan Mechner and Richard Garriott.
I have. Actually, it's one of the great kind of, and that's a weird thing where you go to these things and then, you know, Richard Garriott sent me a thing after I got in the Hall of Fame, and that's like where you go, like, is this real? Is this, you know, he's fabulous. You know, one of the most amazing creatives our industry has had.
He's been to space.
He has, and back from Russia, and they land. Yeah. The thing I love there is they don't land in the water. They land on the ground. They have just big springs or something.
So was it a case of, it sounds like it wasn't a case of never meet your heroes. Like it was a cool experience.
I met him a few times. So there was a hero moment. You know, probably when I first started here. So this would have been 25 years ago. Or when he was doing Ultima 8. I met him for the first time. But then we met over the years, and he's been out to QuakeCon. He gave his space talk there.
Nice.
We met an event a few months ago in D.C. as well. So
you mentioned already you're messing around with games. You're starting to toy with programming and making stuff. Did you ever want to be anything else when you grew up besides a video game developer?
Wanted to be? No. I thought about going to movies. I actually have a finance degree only because it seemed like the easiest way to get through college at the time. And I actually interviewed at Circuit City because their headquarters were nearby where I went to college at William & Mary.
Yeah.
And they turned me down for the job. And I was like, all right, I don't even know why I was doing that anyway. And we're at Circuit City today, so there's that.
Yeah, you made the right choice,
yeah, exactly.
Clearly.
And I was like, well, I'm gonna chase this video game thing. I'd rather do that and see where it goes. But at the time, it wasn't a career that you would choose wisely. You know, you're looking at 93, 94.
Yeah.
And my parents were sort of, are you sure you want to do this?
Finance seems like an odd, like not even like computer science or...
Well, what happened was I did computer stuff on my own, but they wouldn't let me jump ahead in those courses. So I kept doing it on my own. I kept programming and making my own things. And I took one computer class just to up my GPA some,
right.
I think. Just to like,
just
okay,
add the stats.
I'll just jump in, give me the A. But they wouldn't let me jump, you know, to the 300-level courses
that,
or whatever.
That seems
But this was a long time
right?
ago, right?
Yeah.
So I think today it's very, very different, where programming and those kind of things in college, it's pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah, because finance, and then you also double majored engineering, too.
I did some. I don't actually... You're probably reading that off my Wikipedia page.
Some of which may involve Wikipedia.
like, not factually correct on that one.
We may want to fix that after the interview.
Sure, yeah.
It's the beauty of Wikipedia. We can go fix it.
But I almost had a minor in art, so I did. So I was interested in art as well. So when it came to the gaming, it was a lot of graphics programming as well. How could I get these things to work? So it was a mix of business school, art stuff, and then programming on my own.
So were your parents rooting? They were probably, it sounds like they were happy with the finance degree, like, great, he'll get a good job, he'll
you know
be
what?
Fine.
They were great in supporting me and saying, hey, whatever you want to do that really inspires you and makes you happy, go do that, and, you know, the rest of it will work out. Don't chase a job for money, which I think is the best advice.
What do they think of your success now?
They didn't quite get it for a long time. They generally thought that I was a professional goof-off. and I don't think it was until other people mentioned it to him. You know, when other people would say, hey, I saw Todd in this thing. Or they would run into somebody and they'd say, oh, my son makes video games. And they'd go, oh, what kind of games? And they'd say it and they'd go... And they would know who I was, and then I think that's when it clicked.
Did they come to the Hall of Fame ceremony?
No, my father had passed away.
Oh,
my mother was unable to travel, but my brother was there, and we still got to celebrate all that.
Awesome. So in between your graduation in '93, you get, and then when you get hired at Bethesda in '94, were there any, did you have any like interesting odd jobs during that time or?
No, I had come by Bethesda before I graduated. So I swung by, it was Martin Luther King weekend of my senior year. And I, as the story goes, I drove by the office. I was living in Pennsylvania and it was on my way back to William & Mary. And I drove, I used to stop by the office. I just drove in cold and knocked on the door and
said—
And
they told you to stay in school.
They did. I said, I want to work here one day. And they said, well, are you available? I said, no. It's just FYI. And they told me to come back after I graduated. And I pinged them after I graduated, but there weren't any openings. And I actually got a job at a small place that called Ablesoft, which got bought later by Micro League, who made old Micro League soccer. And so I was doing little Windows games and apps.
Huh.
Well, I'm calling it apps. They weren't
right,
then.
Right, not then.
But little Windows things and other programs. We did some small games. Worked on a thing. I was really into comic books, too. We did a thing called the Comic Collector that let you organize your comic collections.
Nice.
And they sold these in, at the time, you know, what was Electronics Boutique and Babbage's and CompUSA and all of these places. And I got to go to things like GDC in the early years. This was in 93.
Yeah.
And the precursor to E3 and those kind of things. And I would go by Bethesda and say, well, let me know when there's an opening. And eventually they did. They said, hey, we got something. Why don't you,
eventually you got
why don't
there.
You come in and talk to us? And I did.
And your first game was Terminator Future Shock, which I remember playing that game. I remember thinking, wow, this is a really cool Terminator. It's a first-person Terminator game. How great is this? So what was your approach? You did some design work and you were a producer on that.
Right.
What was sort of your approach to it with minimal previous experience to fall back on at that point?
When I got, that project was going when I got here. I actually helped produce briefly a college basketball game that Bethesda had that was being done outside. They kind of gave me that and the CD-ROM version of Arena. Arena had just come out when I started. And that was a game that convinced me also. This is where I went to work. I was into sports games. I was into RPGs. I was into, like, you know, all of that stuff. And Future Shock was just starting to get going, and it was the advent of, hey, we have this 3D engine, the X engine, and this is the kind of game we want to do. And Daggerfall was just in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me on as the producer, and which, looking back, is like way over. Like, I don't know why you would
You're
put
like
me.
You're like a 22-year-old kid.
Like, okay. But it was a very, the point is, I think gaming then, people know, is very, very small. Everybody had to do everything.
You're down in the basement, like, boxing up copies, right?
We were. We would box the copies and send them off. And so, but that was, I don't know, it's a team of 6-7 people, maybe, and everybody did everything. And that was, like, the best way to learn very, very quickly how to do this.
Do you remember, what do you remember about that project? Like, do you, when I say it, do you think well of it? Do you think, oh, not that game? Or what's, how do you remember?
I loved it. It was like, is this how this shit actually works? Because at that time, legally, no one owned the Terminator license. I don't know if it was like legal battle, but I'm going to get this wrong. Carolco, Hemdale, somebody, and they got in a fight over the license.
Yeah.
So we were doing, in that period, we were doing Terminator games and checked with nobody. Nobody said, like, we approve that or don't approve
that.
We did whatever the hell we wanted.
Awesome.
But we were fans of it, so we'd pick apart the movies, and we just made the game, right? So that kind of, it also shows, like, that kind of, you know, okay, we really want to dig in and make this feel right, but without somebody saying no, we can move very quickly and make what I think is a fabulous game. And I think in many ways was ahead of its time. It was the first full 3D first-person shooter.
Yeah, I remember.
First PC game with mouse look. Which a lot of people were like, why would you do an interface like this? They're very used to Doom.
Oh, yeah.
And, the WSAD controls were what we had in Terminator. So I look back very, very fondly. And the other thing when I think about it is, obviously we get the Fallout license later, which seems like a departure to us. Whereas if you look at Terminator, we had actually been alternating post-apocalyptic 3D worlds and fantasy.
I never thought about it.
Right, exactly. So when it comes to Fallout, It wasn't that, okay, we've built these destroyed cities. Here's how we did it in Future Shock and Skynet, the multiplayer one. And it wasn't that long ago. Some of the people were still here, like myself.
But so it sounds like, if you remember this fondly, it'd be cool to do a re- sounds like you'd be down for a remake, but the licensing now would probably just be a giant nightmare and not worth it.
It probably would be, yeah. And we have other things to work on. But I did a design for like another one after that called Terminator Dawn, I think it was, where you became the Terminator. But it never got off the ground because then the rights started being acquired.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, you know, we have other things to do.
What'd you learn from that? You know, Future Shock being your first like full major game project. Are there any sort of core lessons that you remember from that? Or,
I mean, mostly it was that even on a small scale, these things are group efforts, right? When you're doing it on your own before you get into a studio, it's all up to you. And I could do a lot of things, right? I could program, I could do art, I could do level design, I could produce, I did the sound effects for Terminator and Daggerfall, and some for Morrowind, then I stopped. But your ability to work with a group and get the best out of everybody, even you know, at that scale, made all the difference.
Yeah.
And then when you get it on a larger scale like we are now, it still makes a very, very big difference. It's a team sport.
So you moved on to Elder Scrolls after that, which had, as you noted, already started. Arena had already come out. Now, given your penchant for role-playing games as a kid, is that dream come true territory where you are now, you've gone from playing role-playing games as a kid to making your own?
Looking back, yes. At the time, it was the ours were so big, right? Whereas Terminator, you could focus a little more on a level, even though the levels are wide open expanses. An Elder Scrolls game is so big at the time, very procedurally generated as well, and it was wrapping your hands around what's going to make this tick on a minute-to-minute basis in the game, and so. It wasn't until probably later into Oblivion where I started feeling like, okay, this is the type of thing that you know, we fulfilled the dream of this is what we should be making.
And it took you that long, not even Morrowind sort of.
I think in the Morrowind, but getting through it was, we were making Oblivion, so it was after Morrowind came out.
Yeah.
Morrowind we can get into, but it's a time of. You know, the company going through a lot of troubles, and we got to get this game right. But when we're making Oblivion, we had more resources, a lot more we could do at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Had you played Elder Scrolls Arena prior to joining?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh yeah, so I loved it.
So you were able to just sort of dive right in.
Oh, very much. Very much.
At least as far as the lore and all that stuff.
There's very little lore in that game, but the type of game it was.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a first person. It's like Ultima Underworld on a very grand scale is what it was going for.
So then you move on to Redguard, project leader there.
Yeah.
And so you're then tapped to lead Elder Scrolls 3.
Right.
Morrowind. So did you at the time see that as, okay, this is my big opportunity to, like, prove myself here? Or...
In some ways, yes. What was going on for us in the industry at the time? I had led Redguard, a game I love.
Yeah.
You know, I've always liked genre mashups. You know, Star Control 2 is one of my favorite games. It's a great game, The Horde, actually made by the same people, I believe. Redguard was very much of a mashup. It's an adventure game. It's an action game. It's got a little bit of an role-playing stuff in it. But the game did horribly, right? It was the wrong game at the wrong time, probably on the wrong platforms. And the company had really, really shrunk. Okay, so, and Morrowind had fits and starts and been put away. And it was really the Redguard team that was kind of left. And it was while we were making Redguard, they said, hey, we want you guys to go after Morrowind next. Todd, we want you to lead it.
Yeah.
And given how Redguard did, and we had some other fits and starts with Battlespire, and it was very clear, okay, this is kind of our last shot, right? And the company changed hands. That's where Bethesda then, ZeniMax Media was formed, right. And Bethesda Softworks became part of that. So it wasn't that it was necessarily my shot. It was kind of everybody's last shot is how I'd say it.
And is there a tangible pressure at that point, or are you able to kind of not worry about that?
Yeah. No.
Well, major pressure?
It was pressure, but you're also not worried about it because you just went through, hey, this company could close. Right? So it's also freeing in that, okay, we went at this with no fear.
Right.
But there's still that pressure of, if this game doesn't succeed, we're probably not a company.
Which
is pressure.
Right. So did you stop and think like, all right, well, if this fails, what am I going to do?
Maybe I did. I don't think about it that way sitting here. When I look back, I think about it in terms of we were very, very aggressive. Like, the sky was the limit, because why not, right? What's going to happen? What's going to happen is where we were. Like, well, we're all hosed.
Yeah, shoot for the moon.
Right, exactly. Shoot for the moon. And this is what we should do. And we had very strong convictions as to the game that we wanted to make and how we were going to go about it.
So then Morrowind takes off. First on PC, and then it comes to Xbox. So did you have any inkling that it would translate well to consoles? Like, did Microsoft come to you guys and want that game with the PS2 being, you know, really a home for Japanese RPGs? Like, what was sort of the story behind the sort of console success of Morrowind?
They did. They came to us when they were just about to announce the original Xbox. And we had a relationship, obviously, with Microsoft from the PC days. And we were, I was doubtful at first. You know, we were very much a PC shop.
Yeah.
How will this translate? First of all, can we do it technically? Number one. Really difficult proposition at the time, given the memory on the system. Number two, if we can say we can do it, how will it translate, both interface-wise and all those things? So let's say we do all that. Number three, is anyone going to want this? Like, console RPG at the time is very Final Fantasy.
Yes.
And we kind of put that number three away, right? There's nothing we can do about that. People want it or they don't want it. Let's focus, like, technically, how does the interface work? And Microsoft was awesome. They were an incredible partner in having us look at some interfaces and best practices. Technically, they helped us as well. But that was one of the Herculean, magical, the fact that we pulled that off, even today, I cannot tell you how that game works. I know, but it's it's pretty miraculous, and it was there was a slight gap between the PC and the Xbox, maybe a month or two?
Yeah.
I forget. But I was shocked at how well it did in Xbox. It became the dominant platform for the game. At the time, and I don't know the period of it, but it was the second best-selling game behind Halo.
I believe it.
Which, I mean, I don't think you go into that expecting that. And that did reorient us in terms of, hey, there's an audience for this that wants to play these kind of deeper experiences, despite it being hooked to a television. It doesn't, like, the device doesn't matter as much to the audience, whereas you'd say a PC player thinks this way and a console player thinks this way. That definitely reoriented us to say, hey, going into Oblivion, we need to think of it like this.
And is it life-changing success of Morrowind overall, you know, PC and console, or is it just a reassuring
It's
success.
A reassurance. No, it did well enough on the PC that we said, okay, we're good. We can, financially, we're set. We can go into Oblivion and most places would say, okay, you have this huge success in Morrowind. Where's our sequel in a year or 2 years? And the fact that I was able to go and say, we'd like 4 years and to make a next-gen RPG, it's sort of like, you know, that was a little bit of a conversation, but not as much pushback as you would think. It's one of the great things about this company is they let the creatives, like, what do you really want to do? What's your vision? How do we make it happen? And that has been one of the amazing things about ZeniMax and Bethesda across all of the studios that you don't see anywhere else. And I think part of that reason is because we're a private company.
Right? Yeah, no shareholder standards.
And that jump is, okay, let's take 4 years and reboot all of this stuff after one success. That's pretty rare. And the other thing that happens in between there is, what else do you want to do? And that's where Fallout comes in.
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. That's
yeah, I don't want to jump ahead in your questions.
No, it's... but yeah, I mean, ZeniMax has put a lot of trust in you for a long time. And you've paid that trust off handsomely.
Well, it really is a partnership. I could not do it, honestly, without the people that I work with within ZeniMax who support this. Like, and they're awesome, awesome partners.
Like we're going to go, we'll talk about this later, but we're probably going to be going a decade between Elder Scrolls games. And at any other publisher, they would laugh you out of the boardroom and fire you and say, no, we'll bring
somebody
that's
going to make one. Well, I can't say they're ecstatic about that one, right? Right?
But okay, Oblivion, which you've been alluding to, that for me, that was the one for me that made me a super fan of what you
guys
do.
And I think that's where we first met.
It was. Yeah, I joked, I think, with Pete Hines at the time, I should have had a desk here during the
Oblivion
times. I was out here a lot, and it was I have fond memories. I remember we did an exclusive review of Oblivion for Xbox Magazine, and I was in a conference room in the basement straight below us. 11 hours a day for four days.
Was it that?
And there was the hotel was right next door before it was converted into
the apartments there.
Yeah, so I'd literally just walk back.
You did a number of previews, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Oblivion really was, hey, this is a true next-gen.
It was.
The, kind of the first new next-gen game.
Yeah, because it was the big, you're right, next-generation experience. I mean, it was kind of you guys. Ghost Recon, Advanced Warfighter was another big one early on. Gears of War wasn't coming
Fight
out
Night?
Till the fall. Fight Night was beautiful.
Was it Fight Night?
Yeah. Yeah, that was good. But then and then Halo was, you know, off in the distance. So it was all about you guys. And that's so with Oblivion. It sounds like the discussion with Microsoft happened very early on for doing something on the Xenon.
Exactly. Good pull on the code name.
I've been around a while.
Yeah, after. After the Morrowind hits, it was, okay, we want you guys on the new one right away.
Yeah.
And it was a very early conversation. Here's what we're planning for hardware. Here's this. And again, that helped tremendously. And we were going to be a launch title. And
That's what I was just going to ask you. Yeah, that was the plan, right?
That was the plan. We ended up in the launch window.
It was pretty close.
You know
March.
What? For the scale of that game, we hit 4 months after launch on a new system for that kind of game. That was another incredible effort, but it was, you know, that was about as close as I think as anyone's ever done it.
Yeah, and it was, do you think in hindsight, would being a day one title have made any real difference in the game went on to tremendous success, but would day one have made any difference?
I don't know. Sales-wise, I don't know. The quality-wise, it would have made a huge negative difference.
Right.
Right, because you're still looking at at the end of the day, it is how much time do you have on the final hardware? And in those days, you know, the hardware is coming in pretty hot. You're working on emulators and things like that before that.
Mac G5 dev kits, as I recall.
Right, but if you move 4 months, it may seem like 4 months, but that could be double or 300% longer on final hardware than in November or whatever day it was.
Now, there's sort of a famous story that Peter Moore told on my show one time about, I mean, it's told it elsewhere, but about Epic really pushing them with specific regard to Gears
Memory.
Of War
we were
on
doing
the RAM.
The same. Oh, my gosh.
So did you guys have any sort of influence on the hardware?
Oh, my gosh. Because with Oblivion, you can only imagine.
I can imagine.
when they told us, we threw a party. I have pictures from the party. We had a double the memory party in the studio.
That's so great.
Yeah, we got drinks and the programmers are I think it was the only time we've ever done that for someone calls and says, yeah, okay, we've upped the hardware.
So you'd been leaning on them as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Leaning's the wrong word. Again, it's a partnership,
well,
but
sure.
It was more of a here's what you're gonna get without it.
Right.
Here's what you're gonna get with it.
What would we have gotten without?
You might not have gotten the game, so
really?
I don't know. There's always sacrifices to be made. I don't remember per se, but the things we would have had to give up to get it to run were going to be extreme.
So, I will never forget like walking out of that dungeon, that jail cell for the first time, and then when you first emerge into the open world in Oblivion, what do you think about when you think about Oblivion now?
And that was definitely, at the time the stepping stone for us, where the people who played our games became so much larger that you couldn't quite take it all in. Whereas Morrowind, it was popular, but you could appreciate what the community was saying and things and the type of players that we had, and Oblivion just goes, you know, where it seemed like everybody was playing it.
Yeah.
And that they were experiencing that type of game, the amount of new players, that's a better way to say it, right? The amount of new people coming to that kind of experience was large.
And is that the life-changing success? Because it seems like that's where it just went into the stratosphere.
It's like you're just like going up.
When does Todd Howard become Todd Howard?
I don't know. You can tell me. I feel I'm quite the same. It's been slow, right? And you say, we've been doing this. I've been at the same place for 25 years with a lot of the same people. It's very gradual for us. Or it's like because the games take 3 or 4 years, like getting a new degree or going to school again, you learn something new, and then it goes to this, and it goes to this, and it goes to this.
Do the expectations, you got done praising your overlords here,
right.
I'm putting a lot of faith in you, but what happens to, if anything, to the expectations on you and on your team when Oblivion goes through the roof?
Well, they want to know what we're going to do next, right? So, hey, what's next? And there are obviously certain financial expectations, but those usually, they're obvious business things with what are you going to spend on the next game?
Yeah.
And when one's successful, not that they give you a blank check, but they say, just tell us what you want to do. And I've always been somewhat, compared to our competitors, conservative. I'd rather spend longer with less people than put 1,000 people on a game and try to do it quickly.
Because is your personal team, you manage one team here, or has it turned into more now?
It's more.
I know you have the satellite studios and you oversee all that, but is it still one team under you, or?
Well, that's a tricky answer in terms of we move people between projects now. And we had sort of done that when we got Fallout, where we'd have some people on Fallout and then on Elder Scrolls, and then there's usually like a 2-year period where everybody's on the game that's coming out. So it was a lot easier to kind of, we're a one project, one team studio.
Right.
Now we're 4 locations in North America. Typically what was 100 people here in Rockville is now 400 and some spread between Austin, Dallas, and Montreal. We can talk about how we got to that.
Yeah, we will.
But we felt we needed that scale to do some of the things that we were doing coming up, and we're able to do more stuff, but still when we have a game that needs people on it, we move people to it. And how I spend my time has definitely changed.
I am definitely curious about that, but I first wanted, before we leave the Oblivion era,
right.
I got to talk to you about horse armor for a second.
I can talk about that at length.
Good. We have nothing but time. That's the beauty here.
Let's spend a good 20 minutes on horse armor.
Buckle up, everyone.
Right?
Yeah. If you're hardcore enough to watch this podcast, odds are.
You want to know the story behind horse armor.
So
ringtones.
It was horse
That's
armor.
The anecdote.
Horse armor was one of the first bits of paid DLC.
I think it may be the first.
May have been the first.
I don't know.
People tell me it's the first,
but I'm not sure that's true.
It was definitely one of the first. We can agree on that much.
We can agree on that.
How much horse armor did you sell?
People will buy anything. That doesn't mean you should do it. They will buy anything. That sounds terrible.
That sounds real bad.
Horse armor is not bad. I think horse armor is fine. The price point at the time was the issue. And Xbox, they were doing themes. And
that
ringtones were big at the time. That's why I say ringtones.
Yes.
Ringtones are just crushing it financially for Nokia, whoever.
On your Nokia candy bar phone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they started selling themes. And we said, we want to do expansion packs. We had done some for Morrowind. We'd rather have this free-flowing kind of DLC into the game. We have lots of ideas. We did a bunch for Morrowind and put them on the website for free. We're very into that, the creation kit and the modding and all of that.
Yes, you guys always have.
Okay, so how do we get this to console players? We'll do it this way. And horse armor is for what it is, actually, I think it's fine. You armor your horse, you can buy it. There's new dialogue. It ups its stats. And we felt, well, it's probably worth this. And I won't say who at Microsoft said, well, that's less than we sell a theme for. We're, like a wallpaper is
right.
more than that.
Right.
You should charge this. You can always lower it. We're like, okay. And so I think it's a price to value proposition at the time, not do I want armor for my horse.
Yeah.
And looking back now, it's quite cheap compared
well,
to what
now.
Some people. Yeah. But what's funny is for a long time, every April Fool's Day, we would do a DLC sale for Oblivion and double the price of horse armor. And it sells more than everything because people are in on the joke.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Did the horse armor put your kids through college?
It will. That's not, you know, it sells a lot.
Yeah.
But again,
what else was on the whiteboard when if you've had this meeting with Microsoft and they're like, we want some paid DLC.
The other stuff we put out. We did the Strongholds. Yeah. We did Shivering Isles. We did Knights of the Nine. If you
right.
look at Oblivion, I think actually has an awesome suite of content that you can buy. Of different size, and the Mehrunes Razor dungeon, I think, looking back. And you can see us quickly adjust, right?
Yeah.
Price point to quality.
Yeah, Knights of the Nine was a more sort of traditional expansion.
Right,
sorts.
If you look at Knights of the Nine, I forget how much it was, but it's maybe...
Might have been 10 at the time.
Maybe, and Horse Armor was maybe, I don't know if it was $3.
I think it
bucks.
Was $3,
okay.
if memory serves.
So, but we're always chasing that, right? Where the price, I think others do as well, where... Given how much we jam in a game for $60, we can never quite meet that value proposition with any extra content because there's so much we give you for $60.
That's true.
And that's, you know, look, anytime people are doing new things, they're going to go through that process.
So you alluded to this already, and you've told me the story before, but I don't think at IGN. So Fallout, the acquisition of Fallout. You had reached this level of success here that... If I remember correctly, the story goes, they asked you what you wanted to do next, mm-hmm. and you told them you wanted Fallout, so they just went out and got it for you.
That's the shortest version of it, but but true. Yeah, and that's another thing that's special about this place is, okay, we want you. Okay, what do you want to do other than Elder Scrolls? Morrowind has become this huge hit.
Yeah.
So this is between Morrowind and Oblivion.
Right.
2004, I believe. So just 2 years after Morrowind.
Interplay was going under-ish.
They're going under-ish.
There was the MMO.
Well, the way it happens, we made a list of what else we'd like to do.
Yeah.
And a post-apocalyptic game was number one, and it was Fallout. Like, hey, this would be the perfect fit. We have a vision for what we do with it. This is the perfect fit. And some folks in the company knew folks at Interplay who ran it, and our actual pitch was it was a license deal. We didn't actually buy it initially. We licensed it, which is probably why they picked us out of others, right? And here's what we're going to do with it.
Right. Because you were going to enhance their value in their eyes, or their IP's value.
Exactly. But it was something we felt strongly, obviously, would be great for us as well. But it's a license deal. And it was during development that it came up, hey, let's buy it out. And then that deal was done before the game came out. But initially, it's a licensing deal. And the odd thing there is, we announced it before Oblivion. So Fallout 3 gets announced by us before Oblivion gets announced. And that was also a thing I remember at the time saying, we had done Morrowind, and then we're going to announce we're doing Fallout 3, which throws the Fallout fans for a loop and the Elder Scrolls fans for a loop, right? So that's like a no-win announcement right there. And I think we added to it, yeah, we're doing it along with the next Elder Scrolls. So even though Fallout 3 was going to be a ways out, but that was one of my favorite experiences making a game by far was Fallout 3.
How history has now repeated itself, where everybody just keeps harassing you about Elder Scrolls 6, and so last year you got to go out on stage and say, "We're making it."
Exactly.
Now be quiet
exactly.
for a while, please.
Right. Right. We got to be careful going to E3 and saying, "Here's a Fallout game. We're not sure everybody wants. There's an Elder Scrolls game. We're not sure everybody wants." Might as well say we're doing these other things as well that we're pretty sure you want from us.
What was it about Fallout that had appealed to you?
I love you
played the originals.
Oh, I love it. It is just.
Yeah.
I think that world is complete genius. And if you, and it, I think it's shown when you look at all the other post-apocalyptic stuff that's come out.
Sure.
That basic world that the guys at Interplay did, you know. And that because that's the answer. Why don't you just do your own post-apocalyptic world? And it would not be the same, right? This the world there that got destroyed is really interesting, and you can't kind of shoplift that.
So a lot of people, I won't make this a blanket statement, but I've, in conversations with colleagues, friends, I've noticed a theme, maybe it's just me, that people seem to, you know, they really like your games, but they tend to genuinely, like, really prefer Elder Scrolls or Fallout. I don't meet a lot of people that are like, I just love both to death. Most people tend to be like, yeah, I like them both, but, man, I'm an Elder Scrolls person. Do you find that? And which, do you have a favorite child of the two?
I do not have a favorite child. I like going between them. They have different tones, so it's nice to spend time in each one. I think you're probably right there. We have a lot of people that play both, without a doubt. We can see that data.
Sure.
There's a huge crossover.
Yeah.
Plus, otherwise, you can also see it in the success of the games. You know, Fallout 3 would not have been the Fallout 3 the way it was without Oblivion, right? So Fallout 3, in some ways, is the follow-up from us to Oblivion.
Yeah.
And then Skyrim wouldn't have been what it was without Fallout 3 and Fallout 4. Like, yeah, okay, I don't need to do them all. But I agree with you that when I do meet people, they definitely, I play them both, but I love this one.
Yeah.
You know, I really love this world, or I love this world. And they have very different tones, so it's understandable.
Do you think it is the tone that people tend to gravitate a little maybe one way or the other?
Definitely. I think when you spend time in these games, you think about who you'd really be in that world and whether you want to make that your home.
Yeah.
And some people get excited by, what would I do after the world's destroyed? And where would I find the humanity in that? And then a fantasy world has opportunities in a different way. And so, I completely understand it. I never try to convince people of the other. Fallout 3, the one thing we got posted a lot was some people would say, well, I do find it very depressing. So I don't. People would say, okay, why didn't it stick with you? Like,
right.
it gets kind of dark.
And I think that's why I'm in the Elder Scrolls campus, because your games are about living somewhere else. I like living in a medieval high fantasy setting, and it's a lot more bleak to live in a post-apocalyptic.
It can be bleak, but that's coming into Fallout 4. That was one of the themes. How do we make this your home?
Yeah.
You know, that's where you're in the building things and stuff like that.
How important is it to the creative health of your team to, I know you said you kind of will flow people back and forth, but generally speaking, you know, you're kind of focusing on Elder Scrolls or Fallout and now Starfield, which we'll talk about, but how important has that been over the years to the creative health of your team, rather than, you know, you see studios on other franchises that are just at work on the same thing year in and year out?
I think it's important, though. A lot of people they love these franchises. They would work on them for 10, 20 years in a row if we let them. It's more about not having a game every other year or every year where they feel like, oh, we have a release. They do feel like, okay, we can take our time and do something unique with this each time.
So you think it's interesting. You think it's more about not wearing out the fans than wearing out the developers.
No, the fans want it. If you gave them one in two years, that if you could hit that quality bar, we have shown they want it.
Yeah.
But that's just not, you know, the quality is going to suffer.
Right. Yeah, makes sense.
It's good. I'm just saying it's not essential.
Yeah.
Right. It's very good that we get to move between it, because you miss it, right? When we had come to Fallout 4, we hadn't worked on Fallout in a while because we've been doing Skyrim, and you really kind of miss it. And then when we start looking at Elder Scrolls stuff, we miss it now, right? So
we miss it.
I know.
We'll talk about that. okay, so you alluded to this earlier. The expansion of your empire, Bethesda Game Studios, Dallas,
your words.
Austin. Yeah, okay. Well, sure, I'm the interviewer, they're my words.
Sure.
But I think it's fair to call it the Todd Howard Empire.
It's a very small one, though.
But it's yours.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So how did that sort of all come about? Is that a thing where you just need more resources, and so you go to the company and say, what's the best way for me to get these additional resources? Or is it a thing where they're coming to you suggesting, hey, Todd, we want to get some more irons in the fire, some more stuff cooking. How do we do that? So sort of how does the Todd Howard empire grow to where it has?
I generally always get asked, well, I don't know if I'd call it pressure to hire more and expand so that we can do more. But I like to be conservative about that so that who we are and our culture doesn't change. So here in Rockville, we've grown at the same rate we've always grown. You know, we were 100, now we're maybe then 110, 120, 130, we're maybe about 140 right now. But so not, maybe we add 8 to 10 people a year.
Yeah.
And you could say on one hand, let's increase that growth and just start hiring. But I've seen that go wrong other places. We had an opportunity, so it started with Montreal, where we were working with a group of people, about 40-some that were at another company, and we said, we love working with you all. We would love to open a studio around you. So they were people we had worked with for a long time, years. And Eve LaChance, who runs that studio, one of the best game maker studio heads that I've worked with running that, and it was, we didn't want to stop working together. And so we did that, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, okay, we're going to open a studio in Montreal and hire.
So it was super organic.
Right. And then the Austin studio had been Battlecry.
Right.
That was a studio already within ZeniMax, and there were issues with the project, and the company wanted to pause that project, but we knew some of the people there, and we said, hey, we have this online thing that we've kind of put aside. We don't have the skills for that. We'd love to work with them, but they were already working with the company. We knew them. And then same thing with Dallas. That was Escalation Studios, where we had worked with them for years. In all these cases, we had worked with these people for years before we said, hey,
You dated for a while before.
Right. We dated for a very long time. And so they weren't hiring. There wasn't a hiring pace, right? It was we're already working together. Dallas, they did all the VR versions. So they did VR Skyrim and Fallout 4 with us.
Yeah,
they did the Switch version of Fallout Shelter. And they had been working on Starfield stuff with us. And so it was, hey, we should get.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it.
Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Linsky.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Married.
So if you're if you've got 140 people in this building, is it still at the point where I could bring in any one of them and you would know their name?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So you, you know everybody still.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you know, you see a lot of these, a lot of the realities of AAA game development where it's their 1,000-person efforts and, you know,
yeah,
it's
and it needs to be said, it's not just me. Our average tenure in Rockville average is over 10 years. Over 10 years. And that sort of going through multiple cycles together, I think, is what makes it, it really makes the difference. Where, and some of these people I've worked with for 20 years. And that's just so unique in our industry, and it's, you know, I think what keeps us very, very motivated and like enriched by what we do.
Do you worry about some of the trends you see happening in games with, you know, big rounds of layoffs or you know, just ballooning project costs where it does take however many tens of millions of dollars and 1,000 people thrown at something? Like, just, you know, you've clearly got a good hand on your culture and what you guys are all about, but are you worried at all about the sort of industry at large?
I wouldn't say I'm worried. Those cycles come, right? You gotta, like, I look very holistically at video games and have done it long enough where you look at the previous console cycles or things like that where things happen in the industry. They get very, here's what happens. Something gets very, very popular and everybody chases it. It's like six-year-old soccer, right?
Yeah.
Everyone chases
like
the ball for a while and then it gets oversaturated and then it comes down.
Right, like and Battle Royale right now.
Whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And so those things kind of, they come and go. And I think right now we are in a business cycle where there are certain pockets that, you know, they're getting bubbly and will pop in some way, and hopefully the whatever damage is caused by that is minimal.
So, I mean, there's also a lot of conversation about crunch these days and
sure.
the health of teams and what these human beings have to go through to make these incredible, you know, 100-plus hour experiences like you guys make. How would you classify the health of your team as human beings? How are you guys taking care of them?
Look, we've been through, again, a lot of people here have done it for a long time. So we've been through every type of crunch you can imagine. And long ago, some ones that were very, very difficult for a lot of us, you know, personally and your time and your health and things like that. And we have gotten much, much better at it. So now we're at the point where, hey, we can really manage it, and we have enough people to move them between it. And I think it's why people stay here. I think each studio in our industry is very different. I don't know enough about how other groups run to really judge that. I can only look at ourselves. The one thing I'll say is that I think every game deserves some amount at the very end, at some amount that is healthy to leave it all on the field. Because it's important to us, it's important to our fans. And you just got to make sure that is communicated really well. And look, a lot of industries have people that work really, really hard. The difference in games, when people ask about it, that I sort of tell them is, sometimes in a game, it's a lot of R&D effort. You could spend, you could say, we're just going to crunch. We're going to spend 10 to 12 hours a day, and that could end up being meaningless, right?
Right.
Well, that didn't work. And that's, and you start doing that for weeks on end, that's where it really weighs on you. So that's actually the part that, outside of the hours, that you have to manage.
So if you know, as you read the reports, you know, some of the great work like Jason Schreier's done and sort of shining a light on some of this stuff, do you read those and feel good about what what Bethesda and ZeniMax are doing, or do you read any of that and maybe say, oh, okay, well, maybe I should take a closer look at who we are and what we're doing?
We're always looking at it here, so I don't, you know, reading something about someone else, it doesn't change how we're doing things.
Yeah.
I feel that we've done really well with it, but there are times where we haven't, and we try to catch ourselves very quickly on those.
Yeah. Fallout 76 is a big fall game, not under your personal, like, this team here at Rockville's.
There was a lot of people here involved in it, yeah.
Austin, the Austin team was were they the kind of...
The Austin studio, I mean, the whole studio in Austin's working on it. I think they've done a really incredible job, but there's a lot of people here in Rockville and yeah. in Dallas and in Montreal.
Everybody.
That was a lot of people.
You know, so that project, certainly at launch, was simply just not super well received, critically, certainly. Do you have an idea of how it's going to land, or were you caught off guard by the launch of that
game?
We
knew we were going to have a lot of bumps. That's a difficult development. A lot of new systems and yeah. things like that. Hey, we're going to go try this new thing. And anytime you're going to do something new like that, you know you're going to have your bumps. You know that a lot of people might say, that's not the game we want from you. But we still want to be somebody who's trying new things. And that was a very difficult development on that game to get it where it was. And we were ready for, you know, a lot of those difficulties ended up on the screen. And we knew, hey, look, this is not the type of game that people are used to from us. And we're going to get some criticism on it.
Yeah.
And a lot of that very well-deserved criticism.
Because you'd been on, quite the hot Las Vegas type of winning streak.
Sure.
You personally, like a Todd Howard, your
sure.
name on something. So that was.
But we knew that going into this. We knew it's
yeah.
not that, right?
Yeah.
You would say, look, this isn't a game, even from the beginning, this is not going to be like, you know, high Metacritic game. That's not what this is, given what it is. But we felt strongly this is a game we want to play. This is something we really want to do. And all of the games like this, whether it's us or somebody else, you can go back and look at them. There's a period once you launch. It's not how you launch. It's what it becomes. And, you know, can't be prouder of the team that's worked on it. They've worked tirelessly, and it's really turned around. It's a fabulous game and an incredible community around it.
How do you – is there a strategy for kind of getting over that – shaking the reputation that it got at launch and kind of winning people back over?
I think, there's no strategy other than just keep making the game better. And they'll people who play it and they'll come back. And it was, by the way, it's been very popular, right? So
yeah.
it was a huge release for us. The community around it's really, really strong. Obviously, it got a lot of criticism and stories, and we see all that. And it's not, you don't want to read that, but it is what it is. And again, we deserved a lot of that. So it's just working the issues. Like, hey, what do the consumers want? What do we want? How do we get there? This is a very long tail for us in this game, and there's some awesome stuff coming this year that I think people are going to see at E3 and be hopefully very excited.
Over the course of your career, have you been a guy that's read reviews?
Oh yeah.
Yeah?
I read them all.
So you got to read the good and the bad ones,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. I read all the comments, and look, I've experienced it all, right? We've had the games that hit the high 90s and win all the games of the years, and we have the ones that don't as well, and that kind of comes with the territory. I think it's part of the job to read all of that. And whereas I don't always like the grammar or adjectives they use, I think the intent is always, even like a very mean-spirited comment from a fan, I think the intent behind that is actually well-meaning.
Yeah, there can
like,
be a kernel of...
They love these games.
Yeah.
And they're super important to them. And they're important to us. So I think you have to dig into that and say, okay, where could we have done better? Yeah.
So on that note, like if you knew going into 76 that it was maybe gonna be a little bumpy, what when it actually comes out and you see the real world feedback and reaction to it, and what have you learned from 76?
Well, the main takeaway we had was you gotta let it bake with a large live audience for longer than we did. There's just certain things you can never see until it's running 24/7 for a number of months. So, yeah. You know, if there's one thing that we could have, I think I would have done differently is find a way to let at scale people be playing the game 24/7 before you say, you know, everybody in, here you go, pay us.
So if for instance, if you maybe you wish you'd launch that into Steam Early Access? Xbox game preview and, you know.
Or something like
those things.
You know, okay, you're a Fallout 4 player. We're going to let you in the beta for free for this period of time.
Yeah.
Things like that
yeah.
that I think would have made a world of difference in how the game hit on day one. But it still probably would have had some issues, but we would have had a better look at what they
right.
were.
Right. Do you think 76 has had any lasting sort of damage to Bethesda's reputation or Fallout's reputation?
I'm sure it's had some. It would be naive to say it's had zero,
yeah.
right? But I think if people come to the game now and see what's going on there, I think they'll be surprised. I'm really, really proud of what everybody's done in the game. And because I know where it's going, I think we're definitely long-term believers in what's going to be happening with that game, but more so us engaging with the people who play our games every day. And so it was partly that for me, which is if you look at a Skyrim and Fallout 4, those things, the amount of people that play those games still is... I mean, you can look it up on this. It's staggering.
Yeah.
Millions and millions of people every month playing those games, and we have no touch point with them.
Right.
Right? It's just like, we ship the game, we do some mod stuff, but here you go. And so 76 was also, we need to learn how to be engaging and being able to update and see what players are doing and like be more engaged in that experience than zero. Right? So.
And it's got to be, I don't know how much time you spend sort of looking outward at things, but it's got to be reassuring when you see a No Man's Sky or a Sea of Thieves, some of these other similar kind of service-based games that have that did launch poorly in some capacity or another, but have over time through many an update like come to back to a place where they're now very well regarded and very well liked.
But more than that, it's actually all of them. Right. Yeah, I won't go through the list.
Yeah.
You could take most popular online games and go back to day zero, and they're going to go through their problems. And you're seeing that kind of across the industry.
Yeah.
That was the part we knew. I have to say, that's the part we knew going in. No matter what we do, we're going to have some problems, and we need to make sure we're ready to continue that momentum from before release, you know, right through it.
Yeah.
Our own Elder Scrolls Online.
That's
right.
True. That's a good one.
That's a good one. It's an
yeah.
own company, right? So they helped us on this game. They gave us a lot of vision as to, like, here's how things are going to go. They've helped us post-release. And so our own company has been through that, where ESO, the launch, you know, wasn't a well-received game.
Right.
And that team did incredible work. And you look at ESO now, it's one of the most played MMOs across every platform. It's incredible.
Yeah, an 8-figure million player base.
That's just within our company.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Fallout New Vegas, super well-liked.
Yeah.
Very beloved over the years. Was there ever any thought to doing another Fallout game with Obsidian? Obviously, they're owned by Microsoft now, but did that ever go anywhere?
I wouldn't say. There were conversations. You know, look, love those guys. Fergus is one of, like, I think one of the great people in the industry. And we've always had a great relationship with them. We like to keep it internal because we know what we want to do. So it is, if we can keep it internal, we would. And now that they've been bought, you know, you never say never,
yeah,
but it makes it highly unlikely, I'll say that. And there were obviously very few people when the New Vegas thing came up because we were going to be moving on to Skyrim. You know, hey, we want more Fallout. Like, another thing, this is a hit. What are you going to do next? We're like, Skyrim. And it was, hey, look, there's only one group that we really trust to do this, and it was awesome.
It was only ever Obsidian.
Correct.
Yeah. That paid off.
We got other look,
very well.
We get lots of people saying that they would do it even back then. Like,
yeah.
Hey, you should let us do this, and that was for me. It was the only. It's either this group or nobody.
Who's the most famous developer that you've rebuffed?
That would be unfair.
You can tell me off the air later. So what is the plan, generally speaking, for the new Bethesda Game Studios studios, you know, the Austins, the Dallases, the Montreals, are they there to assist this team's efforts here in Rockville, or are you gonna, or will we see them kind of grow their own IPs or work on, you know, new games and existing franchises?
Well, it's going to be a mix. We need certain scale for all of us to come together on some of the bigger things we're doing.
Yeah.
But there's also individual initiatives led out of each studio. In Montreal, the mobile group is in Montreal, who did Fallout Shelter, who did Blades. And I kind of executive produce and direct them with other people here, but the core team is there. Fabulous group. Dallas, again, they did the VR stuff. And Austin, obviously, leading the online efforts with 76. So it's kind of a mix. I don't want to give a specific answer to that, but
sure.
There are times where it needs to act as one, and there are times where the leadership in those studios is going to be driving something.
Have you played with Valve Index or Rift S and the new VR headsets? And
a little bit.
Is there a future for those in? You know, I don't know if they're ever going to go mainstream. If you know, that's everybody's always waiting for when is VR going to break through. But are you guys are interested in continuing to explore VR?
We are. You know, that's the kind of thing where we start very early. We did on VR initially. It's stuff we love. And I'm still waiting personally, I think, and I've said before, you look historically at those things, it's generally the third generation of something where quality meets price point and the addressable market expands.
Yeah.
And it's gone a little slower than I would have liked.
So we're on Gen 2 now.
Well, we're like in the very beginning.
We're like 1.8.
I don't know. It's going a little slower than I had hoped.
Yeah.
And so we'll see where it heads. Obviously, as it comes to power and portability, that's where VR needs to hit the sweet spot.
So the project that you're, I presume, working primarily on now is Starfield. And that is your first original IP.
Correct.
Elder Scrolls was...
Elder Scrolls.
But yours, specifically.
For me, yes.
I know you're not going to sit here and just rattle off all the features
for me. How
much
time do we have?
Yeah. for a game that hasn't been shown yet. But I did want to ask you just sort of higher level, what are your goals with Starfield? And sort of philosophically, how do you look at it in comparison to Elder Scrolls and Fallout? I just kind of want to get a sense of how you think about this.
That's a good question. First, that old list of... hey, what games you want to do? It was post-apocalyptic and then epic science fiction. And so we've had a vision of that game. It's a game I've wanted to make for a very, very long time. And we felt post-Fallout 4, we knew during Fallout 4 our next thing was going to be Starfield. And had thought about it for a very long time. So the main thing is that you got to look at it in terms of franchise, not just game. What does that mean? What is the tone? So we always start with tone, and I don't want to spoil it now, but have its own tone as far as there's so much science fiction.
Yeah.
In the same way, Fallout has its own tone in post-apocalyptic. Elder Scrolls has found its own tone, but originally didn't. It was very, very generic fantasy. And so I think our aspirations for that game, you know, it's the end-all, be-all science fiction game that everyone's always wanted to play. Well, we could be the ones to pull this off. We have enough talent and experience and technology. We need to write a whole bunch of new technology that we're doing, but we think that we can pull it off.
So when you say, you mean you saying be-all, end-all science fiction game that we've all wanted to play, I mean, that raises... certain, you know,
yeah, I guess that's
thoughts.
That's up for interpretation. My end-all, be-all science fiction game I wanted to play.
But, you know, something you say, I have to say, like, I don't know if it bothered me is quite the right way to say it, but you said you think about it not as the game, but as the franchise. You're a creator. Isn't that... That's almost sounds like more of a business way of thinking about it. Don't you think about the game and then
if it happens to
organically become a franchise?
Sorry, I'd say better. The world it's in is better to say.
Okay.
You can do a game and that just feels like, well, that world wasn't fully fleshed out. That wasn't like, you know, The Fallout is very fleshed out now, even in its initial genesis.
Right.
So that's really what I mean. You have to think about it.
World building, not like six games.
Yeah. No, we have not planned past this game. Yeah. Sorry, probably poorly said, or IP or whatever label you want to put on it. That it needs to be as fully fleshed out as to, how far in the future is it? What happened in all those years in between? What is the technology level? Where do they eat? Where do they go? What do they know? How do they communicate? What are the races or places or people or creatures or this or that and why? That's really what I mean. Like, okay. And have it be its own thing as opposed to that's Star Trek or that's Star Wars.
So
somebody looks at it and says, that's Starfield.
Yeah.
You can look at Fallout and say, that's Fallout.
Well, with Fallout, you just got done saying yourself, you've kind of inspired a whole wave of post-apocalyptic games that have followed and since Fallout 3 shipped. But with Starfield, it's sort of the opposite. We've got no shortage of science fiction video games out there. So are you playing other sci-fi games? Are you reading sci-fi books? Sort of how are you to get yourself in a mindset for where this is going? How are you preparing
yourself?
Well,
first of all, it's a project we've already worked on for... What year is this?
2019.
Okay, so we're 3.5 years in.
Yeah.
You know, we started before that, so it's... we look at all of it. I don't want to really answer that, because then, we look at this one, that'll...
Right,
you know.
I get it.
But we look at it all, and again, that for us is having it be unique, because there is so much science fiction.
So,
I would like to dodge all these questions.
Well, that's...
Yeah. How am I doing?
You can't see the leather binding here. He can't get out of the chair. But no, so this is... So effectively, you have a vision for what the sci-fi game you've always wanted to play, and that's what you're going for here.
Yes, and it's not just that the tone of the world, it's the game flow and the things you can do.
Are you going to tell me about the tone at all?
No.
No?
Well, with the teaser we put out, teases the tone. Yeah.
Fair enough.
I don't know.
When are we going to see more of it? Next E3?
Everyone should be very patient.
That's fair.
Yeah. I will say this. I like it to be very... I like when you really see the game to when it's out is as short as possible.
Yeah.
Short as people will let me.
I mean, with Fallout 4, you guys, again, inspired a lot of other publishers to kind of go that same route of, we're going to announce it and then ship it 6 months later.
5 months, yeah.
Five months.
Yeah, that was as short as I was told anyone would allow me to do.
You would go shorter if you could?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe I'm trying to think what's perfect right now. Maybe a week just to get people excited,
right,
to have those moments of I saw it, there's some trailers, percolates in your mind, and they're...
So you would rather just not even...
Don't hold me to that, all right? Because you should just cut that.
You'd rather just not even... I mean, you're going to put me out of business doing that stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
No. You do this, you're fine.
Well, I do. Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
I'll figure out a way.
I don't know. I think shorter is better.
Yeah.
I think people see something... Like, when have you seen a trailer or a demo and said, I'd like to wait?
Right? Well, I don't think it's that. I get where you're coming from, though. I think more it's...
There's a retail aspect to that where, the retail channel needs to know, and the earlier they know, the earlier they can prepare, the earlier they can leak it, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So,
what's up, Walmart Canada?
Yeah, so it's not just them.
Would you rather games... pivot to be more like film in that regard and just like, hey, here's a trailer maybe 6 months out and then maybe a second trailer and
then film has gotten very different, right? Film has started to tease it really early. This is what we're making. And we're doing that on this, right? We're sitting here talking about Starfield, something that I normally wouldn't do. You would just, come 5-6 months out before it's out.
Yeah.
But I think those kind of things now in terms of letting your audience know, this is what we're doing. This is the order. So people know, hey, we're doing Starfield. We're in the early stages of Elder Scrolls 6, and that will be after Starfield. I think it's good to let, our fans know that to set those expectations.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. On that note, so as I said, and you kind of were starting to, I could see you doing the math in your head to see if fact check me, but it seems like we're probably going to go a decade between major Elder Scrolls releases between 5 and 6.
I think everyone should be very patient.
And that's like What are the sort of pros and cons of letting that series sit dormant for that long? Because there are good and bad things, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, Elder Scrolls Online is hugely, hugely popular. And the team doing that at ZeniMax Online is fabulous. So it's not that we're not feeding high-quality Elder Scrolls to people.
No, but a lot of your fans don't want to play with other people in the Elder Scrolls world. They want to just go off in their
own. Not just that. I think they want a certain type of experience that is very... it's what we've done. We're the world and the things around you. You can pick up this water bottle. You can do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Things that we love. The gap in between is obviously going to be long. It already is. And on one hand, I think it's good to miss things. You know what I mean? I think that makes people come to it with really, really fresh eyes. And I think when they eventually see the game and what we have in mind, they'll understand the gap more in terms of technology and what we want it to do. The one thing it does is people are still playing Skyrim. It's still one of the best-selling games. I know people joke about it online, but it's one of the best-selling games on Switch. Anything we put it out on, it becomes a hit game.
Right.
And they love it. They still play it. It's almost infinitely playable, all of the mods and everything like that. So what that does, and we're 8 years post Skyrim.
Yeah.
It lets us know going into Elder Scrolls 6, this is a game we need to design and people will play for a decade at least.
So technologically, I guess it'll be the first time that Elder Scrolls has missed a whole console generation.
In a certain way, yeah. We put out the special editions, but yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yes, it will.
So
that's a little weird, but yeah.
A little weird. But are you thinking about 6 in a whole new way, or is it just the fact that you are busy with Starfield and can't get to it? Does the technology kind of pair with that at all, with allowing you to change your thinking?
It's a little of both, right? We had done so many things. We're going Elder Scrolls Fallout.
Yeah.
You have this Starfield game in your head. You sort of say, well, when? It could be never. You can say never. But look, we're creatives, and it's like, okay, we have to make this game, and this is the time. And so Elder Scrolls 6 is going to have to wait a little bit. And plus, again, Elder Scrolls Online is doing so well. It's so vibrant that this is the time, both for us creatively and our audience. If we could compress that time and have it all happen faster, I could wave a magic wand. Of course we would. Of course we would. But we're not going to sacrifice that.
But and you've already said you will keep that. I mean, you could theoretically farm it out to one of the other BGS studios and you just oversee it from here if you wanted it, you know, out that badly. But it will be...
Kind of things that we're talking about are going to take a lot of people.
Yeah.
Every BGS studio will probably be involved in that game. And even Starfield right now, it's not really in Austin, but in Dallas and in Montreal, there's staff on Starfield as well.
Developers you admire. That's what I wanted to add. I've got a couple more before I finally unstrap you to that chair and let you go. But I'm kind of curious who you know, you've become, you are a Hall of Famer. You are someone who's... incredibly accomplished in this industry. Who are some of the game developers that you admire?
Well, there's studios and games that I definitely admire. There's people I admire who have gotten to know. I've always been a fan of Blizzard's work. I love the way they go about things, and I just have played their games endlessly. Rockstar, obviously, the work that they've done.
And are they an inspiration at all in the sense of what you said earlier about letting Elder Scrolls sit for a while? They're going to probably go 10 years between Grand Theft Autos. So
I don't use that as an inspiration. Like, that's not inspiring me to take my time.
Okay, they went like 5 years between
right,
GTA
no,
4
it
and
shows,
5.
It
and then,
shows that, you know, the audience will stick around and be hungry.
Yeah, they'll be
for
there
it.
For
right.
you. Yeah.
I would say this. It makes me not worried that the audience is going to go away.
Right.
Naughty Dog.
Yeah.
I know the guys at Insomniac well. Respawn, CD Projekt Red, the stuff that they do is fantastic. If this, I'm on the spot, I feel like I'm missing so many people.
You'll get angry phone calls.
This is weird. This is weird. And this will be a curveball for everybody. EA Sports. I don't think people appreciate how much care they put. I love those games. I actually love American football and play the heck out of Madden. And please bring back NCAA football.
I mean, you said yourself, you started on a sports game.
Yeah, college basketball and game. I love college sports.
Whenever I talk to sports game developers, I do like to sort of tell them that I think they have, tell me if you agree, they have maybe one of the hardest jobs.
They have the most underappreciated game development job.
Yeah.
You have a yearly cadence. You have to mimic something people know for real.
Right.
Right? That's really hard, too. They're also in the, competitive, they get in the competitive esports scene. I love Forza. Just the quality that goes into that game.
Are you a Horizon or a Motorsport guy?
I like them both.
This is the Elder Scrolls Fallout conversation again. People tend to prefer one Forza flavor or the other, maybe even if they like both.
I always like the last one, so the New Horizon is stunning. Yeah.
It's the right answer.
Oh my gosh. The New Horizon.
So good.
The New Horizon is the best one they've done.
Yeah.
But I'm sure the next one will be better. So I've played every single one of those. I love it.
So you've been here your entire career.
Yes.
That is rare these days in absolutely any line of work.
Right.
Even professional athletes, they change teams. And it's certainly rare in game development, too. I mean, it's just not a thing we see very often. Were you ever tempted to go off and start your own studio, or did anyone ever get close to luring you away at any point?
I have to think about it. No. I mean, during the period before Morrowind, it was, this might not go well. I may need to do something else.
Yeah.
Right. Fortunately, it went well. But that wouldn't be from my decision. Like, I don't like the company. It was, this might not exist.
Right.
And then, obviously, you're forced to look for a job. But no, I've been incredibly lucky. This is the only building I've worked in, right? I've been driving this building for 25 years.
Yeah.
Literally, I've spent more time in these worlds than anything in my life. Family, it becomes a part of you on a very deep level, but it's also deeply fulfilling. And so...
Well, on that note, the last question I have for you before I let you go, do you think about what the next 10 years of your career looks like? And do you ever think about retirement? I mean, you're still a young guy, but you've also been here for 25 years. So do you kind of think about ever hanging it up and just going off to a desert island somewhere? Or what's
only when projects are done.
Yeah.
You want to take a break. I actually took a good long break after Fallout 4. I'd been doing it for so long. And that gave me a good perspective on, hey, look, I want to do this for as long as humanly possible, but I do need to do some things differently so that I don't drive myself into the ground.
What's a good long break mean to you? Is that a week or is that a month? Or
I took a 3-month sabbatical.
Nice.
Yeah. Something I desperately needed. But it gave me great assurance that the other leadership here, they're very, very good at what they do. They've been doing it a long time. So it's not just for me. Again, not just me here. I speak for everybody who does this. And myself and others want to do it for as long as possible. And, find a way to do that in the right ways. The industry changes. So how do you move with that? So I don't think about retirement, but I do think about it in terms of, it's not just me. So a lot of other people here with a lot of great ideas who can do a lot of great things. And part of my job is making sure that those voices are heard as well and those ideas come up and that they feel fulfilled.
You on board with this cloud gaming thing? The new, so you think Stadia is going to be a big part of the future?
I think all of that is going to be a big part of the future.
Yeah.
Right? I think you look at every other kind of entertainment medium, whatever, whether it's linear movies, television, music, they all eventually head in that direction. So I don't think it's a matter of if, it's a matter of when most people start playing that way.
And then I got asked too on the same note, circumventing the NDAs you've probably already signed, since we're probably going to get two Todd Howard, Bethesda Game Studios games on the next generation of consoles. What do you want out of those? What do you hope to see from them, sort of technically speaking?
They're all, how to not break NDAs. You're really good at this.
You know how to ask, like, what I've been doing this a long time.
They're doing the right things. They are all. I get
you are
to be,
confident in the direction that these platform holders are heading in.
Absolutely. That's one of the big benefits of my position is I get to see stuff really early.
Yeah.
You know, got to see this, one of the first people ever to see the Switch. And that was, I can say, that's one of the best hardware demos I have ever seen.
What did they show you?
I can't say, but the way they did it was really great. And because you hadn't really seen the device or what is Nintendo doing.
Yeah.
And it's so uniquely them. We fell in love initially, right away. And that's why we've been a big supporter of the Switch. But the things everybody is doing are, in my mind, no one is screwing up at the starting line, which some people have done before.
Yeah. Are there going to be any, or have there been any spec upgrade parties here recently?
Over
whatever's going on.
I think Sony released a little bit of their... they're loading streaming
stuff. Yeah, they talked about that with Wired, with the SSD.
I
so
don't want
to... cool for what you guys do, right? When you're constantly streaming a giant open game world.
Yeah, I don't know if they released... I got to catch myself not to talk about it. Everybody's like, they're either focused on the right things.
Yeah.
And in particular, it helps the kind of games that we make tremendously.
Yeah, and no obvious stumbles out of the starting gate this go around for anybody.
In my opinion.
From a technical perspective.
I think everybody has learned their lessons in some good ways and some hard ways, and they are very, very thoughtful about their audience and the developers. And so I think my view of it is it's gonna be awesome across the board. Not just the systems, but kind of the business models, that gaming is finally reaching the point that linear entertainment is, movies, television, all of that,
yeah,
where you're going to have games that are big tentpoles that people can buy for $60. That's kind of like going to the theater. You're going to have games you can play in a subscription service. You're going to have ones you can download on your phone. You're going to have ones that are you can play and maybe they're ad supported. And I think that's really, really healthy for the industry, not just obviously the players who want to consume it, but the developers who say, I just want to make an adventure game for this budget, that there's an audience for that. And my worry before was, hey, will all of that go away,
right?
There was a pocket in television a while ago where before the subscription services come, where it was all going to crappy reality television.
True.
Because that's where the audience and the money break was. But now you look at that kind of form where there's great dramatic television and series, and there's you got your tent pole theater things that are doing well, and so I see that coming for games where everybody can have an avenue for here's what I want to make and I can find some success.
Todd Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is awesome.
This is a real pleasure for me. It's been a long time since I've had the opportunity to interview you, and I got to come to your space this time.
Exactly.
We didn't have to meet in a horrible, noisy E3 backroom, which always makes it better. But no, this has been another episode of IGN Unfiltered. Stay tuned every month on IGN, on YouTube, or iTunes, or your favorite podcast service for interviews with Todd Howard and other wonderful video game developers. So for more, look for us next month, and we'll see you next time.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.